All right, this week's show on Inside the Black Box is That's No Beer Cooler, Modern Organ Transplants. And our guests to discuss this will be, what, Charlie?
Hey, am I on, Daniel?
Now he's on. He cut you off. We need all four mics.
Gave me the cold mic. How long did it take you to come up with that subtitle?
I believe I thought that went up on when I was driving in here.
Yeah?
Yeah, that's it.
Like right. This morning or driving
no, not
to
really.
The station?
It's been on the website for a few days. Well, here's the problem. Our guests today will be Drs. Chris Larson and Tom Pearson from Emory University. And a few weeks ago, we had some oncologists from Emory. And it really was not science only funnier, because there's nothing funny about oncology, right? And there's probably nothing funny about transplant surgery, but the beer cooler they carry them in...
That's kind of funny.
Is that funny, gentlemen? Can we make fun of that?
Yeah, that's probably the limit. Yeah.
Okay, so there it is, ladies and gentlemen. Organ-filled beer coolers and the modern technology of organ transplants. Next up on Inside the Black Box, science only funnier.
If you like big band jazz, you'll love the DeSoto Hour. Airing Saturdays from 6 to 8 p.m., we'll play old school big band standards from the good old days and much more. So set your radio dial to 91.1 FM WREK Atlanta. Saturdays from 6 to 8 for the DeSoto Hour.
Start your Friday off right? Look no further than Coffee and Sushi, airing every Thursday night, Friday morning from midnight to 1, right here on Rec. I'll be mixing chill out, lounge, down tempo, and just about all kinds of smooth, ice cold grooves. Every edition delivers fresh tracks from one of the most overlooked genres in music. Check out the most recent playlist at wrk.org/coffeeandsushi. Soul with Coffee and Sushi every Thursday night, Friday morning at midnight, right here on 91.1 FM WREK.
The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this week's edition of Inside the Black Box. You'll notice we are missing our normal theme music, right? That's because Trent's probably out. Trent, our normal engineer, ladies and gentlemen, is out partying in Vegas. Sitting in for us is the able-bodied Daniel Smith, chief engineer at Georgia Tech. And for some reason, we just can't find the theme music. I don't know what happened.
It's a tradition. It's a tradition of these blackout shows.
It's gone forever.
No, our antenna is up and running now. This is not a blackout show.
No, I'm in a blackout right
All
now.
All right. But despite that, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science only funnier. I'm Pete Ludovis, and today I'm joined by my special guest co-host, a man who's really enthralled with library precision, what is it, book cart drill teams. Is that your thing?
I am a warrior king. And you know that.
Have you ever seen one of these
I have.
Library card
drills? It's kind of brilliant, especially when they go up on one wheel and can do a 360.
Yeah.
That's some amazing
they
stuff.
They do a
right
parade
there.
Out in Cobb County, Georgia. Have you ever had one on your show?
No, it's hard to have a visual kind of spectacle on a radio show.
Well, you could have interviewed them, talked about injuries in the course of doing book card precision drill team stuff.
I think you should interview them. I think we should have a special Pete Ludovis and the book cart kind of feature.
Okay, now that we've fallen off the ice, ladies and gentlemen, let's get back to the topic. The topic today is That's No Beer Cooler, Modern Organ Transplants. And a special shout out to one of our regular listeners, Paul, who actually suggested this as a show.
Thank you, Paul.
So joining us today to discuss this is Dr. Chris Larson and Thomas Pearson. And I didn't mention this in the promo, but they are the most dreaded of all academics. Not the MD, not the PhD, but the MD, PhD.
Okay, hold on a second. You're not allowed to have both of those at once, are you? I'm serious. I want to know. What's with the PhD, MD combination? I mean, there's so much school involved. How'd
yes,
you do
they
it?
Are.
Yeah, just never quite got ready to, you know, get a job. So. No, we both were surgeons at Emory and got interested in organ transplantation and then went off to Oxford, England to study the immunology of it so that we could hopefully make a difference for patients.
Nice. So two discrete chunks of education to get doctor first and then PhD second.
That's right.
Nice. I could never, ever, ever do that.
All right, that answer brought to you courtesy of Chris Larson, MD, PhD, professor and chair of surgery, chief of transplantation services, executive director of Emory Transplant Center, and a number of bona fides, the likes of which it would take me the entire hour to read. Dr. Larson is an expert in transplantation surgery, immunology, and immunotherapy. And then we also have joining us is Tom Pearson. Tom, say hello so we know you're here.
Hello. Hello.
There it is. Tom Pearson, ladies and gentlemen, who is the chief of kidney transplantation and Livingston professor of surgery in the Department of Surgery at the Emory University School of Medicine. Now, you work with what? T cells and the fact that they are central and a critical role in the rejection of transplanted organs. Dr. Pearson's research has focused on a better understanding of the critical factors of T cell activation and the function and development of novel strategies to block the rejection response. So
this show is going to be hilarious.
Yeah, absolutely. We will bring the funny like nobody's business, ladies and gentlemen. But at least you guys are normal, right? What a lot of people don't realize is now they've streamlined the MD-PhD program. You can enroll in one single program. Emory has one, joint with a number of universities, including Georgia Tech, where you just go for a million years and do the MD-PhD together. You gentlemen were actually practicing surgeons. You had a life. Then you thought immunology is the key, right?
I'm not sure practicing surgery is a real life, but...
Okay. But it's got to be better than that whole, you know, I don't know how many years it takes, but it's sort of a frightening thing. Well, let's begin the program as we often do. And we don't have our lineup for Science in the News yet, do we?
No, but I can try and recreate it for you.
You want to give it a shot, Daniel?
Yeah.
Actually, suddenly I just got very self-conscious, so...
I think it goes something like, Science... in the News. Oh, okay.
God, that was brilliant.
Was it pretty good? I did not do the original scream on the liner.
I should have downloaded a scream sound effect for you.
Okay. That's what I use anyway. So, but in any case, our Science in the News comes, as it often does, from this week's Tuesday edition of Science Times from the New York Times, an article by Lawrence K. Altman entitled Snakes' Feet May Inspire Heart Drugs. Pythons are known for their enormous appetites, and a single meal that can devour animals at least as big as they are, deer, alligators, pigs, household pets. And I will tell you this, the photo they had there was a python eating an alligator. That just made my morning. I mean, I was not awake till I read that.
Mid-consumption.
The tail is sticking out.
You can still see the alligator tail.
Yeah, absolutely. So equally remarkable is what happens inside the python as it digests its prey. Within a day, its internal organs can double in size, metabolic rate, and production of insulin and lipids soar. And it's this biochemistry that causes, let's get this right, gentlemen, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, hypertrophy. Right? So hyper meaning more than usual, right? You guys are big on the Latin. Hypo is less than usual. Iso means same. That's usually what we use in the middle. So hypertrophy actually means growth of the cell size as opposed to hyperplasia, which is the number of cells. I used to work with the guys over at MA on that one. But in any case, a lot of researchers think that this hypertrophy might actually be controlled by managing lipids, insulin, and other sorts of biochemical markers.
And does that mean that so the python can take this entire massive
thing? Yeah, because, you know,
it has to expand the cells around it.
You know, anything that produces digestive juices has to increase, right? And there's good and bad hypertrophy, right? So, I mean, if you're a finely tuned athlete, which I am not, you can actually get some enlargement of the heart, your muscles. You can get hypertrophy of your muscles from exercise. That's a good thing.
Secretariat had heart for 3 horses.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But, I mean, very often, what is it, hypertrophy, if your doctor mentions hypertrophy of your heart, that's usually a bad thing because it's signaled by some other pathology. It's usually uneven. Sometimes it's on different sides or different parts. So the point is researchers are very interested in looking at this thing. So understanding such exaggerated variations in this organ size, researchers say, could help them develop novel ways to delay, prevent, treat, or even reverse various hereditary and acquired human diseases. Substances from other reptiles have been used to develop drugs. For example, the diabetes drug Bieta has been derived from the hormone found in Gila monster saliva. And the day may come when doctors literally prescribe snake oil for heart diseases.
And that's a sort of old-timey joke right there, isn't it?
Snake oil salesman.
Mm-hmm. Right. Little vaudeville.
But the point we want to make is where the interesting schema or approach to dealing with certain medical pathologies, dealing with certain engineering limitations, often comes from crazy things. For example, Georgia Tech, as well as many other universities, have centers for biologically inspired design. We've had folks here before. And let's be honest, I'm an engineer. What we mainly do is steal from Mother Nature. If Mother Nature ever filed any intellectual property, any patents at all, we'd be out of luck, basically.
Or just, you know, locked in legal battles for the next 10 years while you produce whatever it is you stole from Mother Nature.
All right. So let's get to today's topic. And later, I'd be very interesting, you know, are there any interesting animal models that you guys have learned anything about immunosuppressants and things like that? But let's start with transplants, right? How did we get started on transplant? Did some nephew of Dr. Frankenstein say, hey, let's cut somebody open and start putting stuff in there, parts is parts? I'm sure it's a much more eloquent backstory.
Well, rumor would have it that the first transplant was in the 5th century, and it was a leg transplant where a gentleman, and it's the lore of Cosmos and Damien, had a leg amputation, and a leg was taken from a moor and transplanted onto his leg. We would guess that the survival of that leg in a transplant was probably measured in seconds or minutes rather than the kind of length of time we're used to dealing with today. But probably the transplant as we know it now didn't really evolve until the last century, and was based on a couple of key discoveries. So Alexis Carrel was a gentleman from Austria who worked at the Rockefeller Institute in New York and basically described how to suture blood vessels together, sew blood vessels together, and he won the Nobel Prize for that, I think.
When you say describe, is that describe the process or describe why it would work? I mean, what's
the detail?
I think he
worked out the technique. He figured out how to take suture, or the suture they had available at the time, and hook blood vessels together such that blood would continue to go through those blood vessels. And it's that basic technique that's the backbone of all solid organ transplant that's done now clinically.
So everybody has to do that. That's the thing
you have to have a blood
do.
Supply to the organ you're removing from one individual and transplanting to another.
What kind of size are we talking about with the suture and the vessels?
Well, it depends on the organ and the vessel. In heart transplant, the main blood vessel coming out of the heart's a very large blood vessel, and so probably an inch and a half, 2 inches in diameter.
Oh, okay.
And some of the blood vessels, for example, involved in the hand transplant that was done recently at Emory would be extremely small blood vessels that would be would require a microscope to visualize.
Yeah, I think those are the ones I think of when anybody says blood vessels, is just that the fine web. I always think of that. I mean, right. I didn't think of the heart, one-inch vessel.
Right.
So heart transplants, that's simple compared to a hand transplant.
Probably not if you're a heart surgeon or the heart patient recipient.
Oh, I was hoping you'd go with me on that one. I'm trying to make this funny, Pete. Help.
That's I believe we've established the beer cooler with the organ in.
That's as far as it goes.
Is the limit of the funny on today's show. But I appreciate the effort.
So the vessel, the suture vessels.
So two key discoveries. One was the surgical technique, and that was key. And then the other key discovery is in large part contributed to by Sir Peter Medawar, working in labs in London during World War II, where he was tasked to figure out, help improve burn care. Obviously, a lot of burn wounds in London in World War II, and he worked in mouse models and basically figured out that if you took tissue from one individual, and in this case a mouse, and transplanted it to a genetically dissimilar mouse, that the tissue was destroyed and that the basis for that destruction was an immune response. And he won the Nobel Prize for that.
Okay.
Okay, and I know we've got Latin names for these as well. So what do you call that? Xenotropic, when you've got a different species.
Xenogeneic.
Xenogeneic, okay. And then there's a whole bunch of them, right? So if it's a different organism but same species, what's that called? Is that allo or?
So, allotransplantation.
Oh,
right?
Okay.
Allogeneic.
Okay.
That's right.
And then it's what? Homo if it's the same creature, right?
Right, or isogeneic if it's the same.
Iso, there you go. Okay.
Isogeneic if it's from an identical twin.
See, look, they like your iso, Pete.
So
they
you guys are just swapping parts from all sorts of people. So basically, the first thing we're establishing is the single most important thing you need to supply is the blood supply. So as soon as we could suture blood vessels, that was the beginning of organ transplants.
And then someone figured out that there are some conditions to what you can transplant, what you can suture.
Namely, the immune response, which is, isn't that the single biggest obstacle in your guys' field? You're good now with the microscopes and now you use these fancy bioabsorbable sutures. It's not like, you know, some silk thing they used way back when. But it's the immune response that is just a total nightmare. Maybe we'll start right into that because that's going to take a while. So how does the immune response work and specifically with regard to organ transplants?
So the immune system is really designed to tell self from non-self. So if you get an infection or a pathogen, your body's job is to reject it and control it. Unfortunately, in the case of an organ transplant, it recognizes the donor's tissue as foreign and mounts that same kind of immune response, which in this case is something we don't want to have happen. So the part of the immune system, the T cells, are what cause the response and cause rejection. So they're the focus of the research and what we want to control selectively.
Is that universal across all animals? Do all animals have that immune response and reject foreign tissues?
Yeah, it's a pretty primitive response. It goes back to early vertebrates will have a rejection response.
And now I'm going to ask a really stupid question, but that's one of the best things.
You often do.
Yeah, the best things about my job is being able to ask stupid questions. Is this completely separate from grafting plants? I mean, do plants have a kind of immune response? Are they able to just deal with having other plants grafted onto them? Is it a completely different thing?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm not sure I know the immunology of the plant. I know that many plants are graftable, and certainly within a species you can graft pretty freely, and then in some cases cross species.
But within a species, okay.
Yeah, but mostly within a species, sure. So I'm a Japanese maple gardener, and you can graft Japanese maples.
Nice, yeah. So plants are one thing, animals are another when it comes to the transplants and what gets rejected and what gets taken on.
And it wasn't, of course, the immune system wasn't designed to reject tissues from another individual of the same species.
Yeah, I'm sure it's very confused. It's like, what are you doing? How did this happen?
Right. So it responds as if it's a virus.
And is that kind of correct, or is that a completely wrong response that has the same sort of damaging effect?
Well, it's a global system, basically. The immune response is designed to, as you said before, reject anything foreign. So the immune response, as it evolved in nature, never anticipated crazy MD, PhD transplant surgeons trying to help people. It never anticipated the crazy viral vectors for DNA therapy that we try to use a virus to get the DNA in there. And we have all sorts of, nasty immune responses. So, basically, immunosuppression is trying to trick the immune response to not reject these good things you're trying to do for humans.
It's like not shooting the maintenance guy when he comes over to the apartment.
That's exactly it. I think it's a little more complicated.
I think what we spend a great deal of our time and effort in clinical transplantation is to try and get enough immunosuppression to allow the transplanted organ to survive and function well and have the patient, therefore, survive and function well, but not too much to get the side effects of over-immunosuppression, infection and right. and cancer.
Right.
So you just shut down. You just shut down the body's immune response, or
well, you really can't, right? Okay. It's because our patients are going to get colds, and they need to get over them, and they're going to have other viruses, and they need to be able to mount a healthy immune response in that setting. So you are walking a fine line between dampening the immune system enough to keep the organ in, but not too much that infections become a major problem.
All right, we need to go take a quick break, but what we'll do when we come back is talk a little bit more about these T lymphocytes and immunosuppression and how you make this whole thing works before we get into some of the fancy new stuff like the hand transplants that have occurred recently at Emory University. We're talking about organ transplantation here on Inside the Black Box. Science, only funnier.
Don't adjust your radio, folks. This is Simply Kosher Noise. Oy vey, these promos never get good signal this far from the Holy Land, so tune into Kosher Noise with your host, DJ Meltz. Feel that Hebrew groove all the way from the tips of your payos down to the soles of your tevas. Tune in to Kosher Noise Monday nights from 7 to 8 p.m. with your host, DJ Meltz.
Hello, welcome to 50 Pounds of Rice.
这是最棒的, 排名第一的亚洲音乐节目。
This is Super Best Number One Asian Music Show.
我是你的主持人郭泽华。
I'm your DJ Winter.
And I'm Jaywalk.
中华人民共和国人民以及亚洲各国人民强烈呼吁你在每周一晚间6点到7点收听我们的节目。
For your own prosperity and good health, the People's Republic of China, as well as other countries from the Far East, would like you to tune in to 50 Pounds of Rice every Monday from 6 to 7 p.m.
我们不见不散.
It's been wonderful, and we look forward to your visit.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking with Chris Larson and Tom Pearson, transplant surgeons, MD, PhDs. We don't normally stress that, but I just think that's the coolest thing ever. You guys ought to have a T-shirt that actually says that. And we've been talking about modern techniques for organ transplants. And, of course, the biggest obstacle to organ transplantation is, of course,
the beer cooler.
Immunosuppression, right? What, Charlie?
The beer cooler, right?
No,
the beer, it looks
no,
silly.
We'll get
that's
back to the beer.
Obstacle.
We'll close with the beer cooler. That'll be sort of a callback on the initial joke. But you mentioned that T lymphocytes, T cells, play a critical role in that. And so what exactly are T cells and what do they do?
So T cells or lymphocytes, they're part of your immune system mm-hmm. that scans for invaders, viruses. Mm-hmm. And they have these special receptors on them that look for... can see foreign proteins in this case, and if they're presented to the immune system, some of those cells will recognize the foreign invader, and then they get activated and turned on. They rapidly start to divide, and you'll have the cells undergo 8 rounds of division within a matter of days. And so what was once a few cells becomes millions of cells that get released into the bloodstream. And then they go to the site where they perceive danger or foreignness and start to do their job. And in most cases, that's control an infection. But in our case, that can be cause rejection.
Okay, so sounds like the Department of Homeland Security, right? They move to the foreign place.
And especially the stuff about there being millions of them very quickly.
Right.
They're
so then is suppressing or modifying or mediating the growth and effect of T cells an important part of this immunosuppression of which you speak?
That's the key element of the immunosuppression that we use in clinical transplantation. And the basic strategy in clinical transplantation is to use a combination of drugs to do that. so that we can minimize, hopefully, the dose of each one of those individual drugs, but in combination or in the sum of all those drugs is enough to inhibit the immune response, allow the transplanted organ to function. And then we always have to balance that with too much immunosuppression and the consequences of that, which would be infection and potentially cancer.
So are the drugs, are they affecting the T cells themselves? Are they stopping your body from producing them? Are they confusing them, like filling their receptors? What's
and the different drugs have different precise mechanisms of action, but they all come to bear on the T cell. And the unfortunate thing is with aspect of many of the drugs we use is that they not only interact with the T cell, but they interact with other organ systems in the body as well, which is an etiology or cause of some of the side effects we deal with those medicines.
What kind of side effects?
Well, one of the drugs, for instance, can cause high blood pressure, can cause increase the risk of diabetes, can cause hand tremor, can cause hair loss, can multiple different organ systems.
Both Charlie and I don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, we're good with the hair loss. So as you improve drugs, are you improving their side effects? I mean, are they all going to work the same, but how they don't interfere with other processes is the way to improve a drug?
Yeah, that's been the basic strategy. So as Tom said, the drugs that really opened up transplantation were this cyclosporin-type drugs, another one called tacrolimus. They do a great job controlling the immune system. The chances of your having a kidney transplant working at a year are probably 98% almost in medi settings. But because they act outside the immune system, that's where we get into the problems. So the focus has been to identify mediators in the immune system that are just in the immune system and to develop those selective targets. And that's been the focus of our work, has been trying to bring that from the laboratory progressively in preclinical models and then to clinical trials. And a new drug was just approved that we had the opportunity to work on for the last 20 years. And it looks like it moves us toward that goal.
Nice. Moves you towards that goal. Do you feel like is it never done? I mean, are there milestones that you can reach and then say, "Good, we're done with that side of it"? Or
we're not there. We're not there. The new drug seems to achieve a lot of the goals. It's called belatacept, but it has better kidney function. It's not toxic to the kidney. Blood pressure's better. Cholesterol's better. So a lot of the side effects are better. But you still have to take that drug, and it dampens your immune system. And we'd like to be more selective there.
And for the rest of your life, you have to take that drug.
And you have to take
the
drug.
That is your drug for the rest of your life.
Right. Now, that's current technology. And the focus of the Emory Transplant Center is to see if we can develop strategies that are selective. So in the T cells that we mentioned, each T cell has an individual little receptor that recognizes something foreign. So only a subset of your T cells recognize the transplant from your donor. And so what we'd like to do is silence just those and leave the rest of your T cells intact. So the goal would be to delete that little sliver of your immune system that's going to cause rejection. So
that just makes my head hurt thinking about that.
Well, along those lines, I mean, so I actually work in the field of molecular modeling. We mainly do synthetic polymers, but we do some peptides and DNA models as well. And this whole lock and key receptor ligand interaction, right? Basically that one receptor works with one ligand. We model that ligand. We see how it interacts with that receptor. They design the drug. They find something that's not so cytotoxic. Boom, you're ready to go. But every time we get in even phase one clinical trials, the problem of these side effects that you describe, it'd be easy to say, well, why can't you guys figure this out? But this is a general problem in medicine. There are so many overlapping and redundant systems. Mm-hmm. The one perfect receptor, you'll be lucky if you get it down so it only interferes with a dozen separate systems as opposed to two or three, four dozen.
Hey, Pete, speaking of overlapping and redundant, you should know that we're listening to WREK Atlanta, 91.1 FM.
Well, thanks for pointing that out.
Just had to do that. but, non-legal ID-wise.
But the question my wife had this morning when I was talking to her about you guys coming on the show is, you take these immunosuppressant drugs for the rest of your lives. Are there long-term effects?
Yes, very much so. Mm-hmm. So the biggest ones, again, that we worry about is the inhibition of the immune system and therefore the increased risk of infections and the increased risk in the long term of cancer. The infections that we deal with so frequently are actually oftentimes viruses that are already in our body that we happily coexist with. And then we get a transplant, we get on immunosuppression, the virus wins out a little bit in the battle versus the T cells. The virus causes symptoms and causes potential, you know, most times just sickness to the patient, not mortality.
One thing to just emphasize, though, is that these patients, it's so gratifying to do transplants, and the alternatives in kidney transplant or dialysis, which has got a whole host of problems, and lifespan is not normal on dialysis. And for liver transplant patients and heart transplant patients, it's life-saving.
Right.
And
right.
So there's that upside of these drugs is that they're life-prolonging and life-restoring.
Right. So let's put that in perspective, namely that you may add many decades to your life with a transplant. Maybe it was a few years short of where you might have gone with immunosuppressant drugs, but if you're on the transplant list, you are basically very near death, right? I mean, this is an emergency situation.
Yeah, certainly in this setting of heart transplantation, liver transplantation, lung transplantation, that's right. Mm-hmm. These are patients that are really waiting for that chance.
Right.
And in the case of kidney transplantation, not only do you potentially increase the quantity of life, but I think almost universally we hear from patients after transplant that their quality of life is better. Mm-hmm. It's their ability to, quote-unquote, live a normal life much, much better with a kidney transplant compared to being on dialysis.
Yeah, and when they say live a normal life, I mean, that is, what are some of the things that can happen to someone when their kidneys are going, their liver is going, their heart's going, when they're still walking around taking part in life? I mean, is that just tiredness, or what's happening to people when
I think basically, as an engineer would probably appreciate this, the human-made machine to dialyze people and replace some of the kidney function, I mean, beats the alternative, which would be death, mm-hmm. but doesn't come near as well as Mother Nature to perfection.
Right.
And, you know, it's very, very hard to carry on a full-time job and be a hemodialysis patient. I mean, there are people that do it, but it's tough.
It's, you know, it's 3 times a week, you know, spending hours on a machine having your blood filtered. And it's, again, remarkable therapy. But it's a tough life. It's hard on the cardiovascular system. It's hard on the metabolism that leads to bone problems. It's got a whole host of problems. You know, and some of the people we transplant are young children. And so to free them from dialysis, to get that a child a chance at a heart transplant and a normal life for our colleagues that do that is pretty extraordinary.
And as a polymer person who's very familiar with dialysis filters and osmotic-type phenomenon, the difference between this basically a series of different, you know, cutoff filters and what sort of the chemical filters like the kidney and the liver do is like night and day. We are eons behind. In fact, we should probably do a program on that, but if we do, our listeners would realize how simple compared to the function of the organ kidney dialysis really is. So that is very true.
We had a caller call and ask about the shortage of transplantable organs.
Right.
Do you want to address that?
So what's being done to address that?
Right. So one of the huge challenges in transplantation, I think you could put improvement in immunosuppression as one of those, and the other is certainly the lack of or the shortage of organs available for transplant. And unfortunately, despite a lot of people's effort, the disparity between supply and demand continues to get worse. The number, as transplant therapy gets better, the potential application to more people becomes evident, and therefore the demand goes up and the number of people on the waiting list continue to grow. There's now almost 100,000 people in this country on the waiting list for a kidney transplant. There are probably 3,500 or so in the state of Georgia on the waiting list for a kidney transplant, mm-hmm. and just not enough organs to meet that demand. In some aspects of transplant, kidney most notably, we have the potential for living donors. So mm-hmm. An individual that's evaluated and found to be a suitable donor can donate one of their kidneys to a person in need. And other types of transplant, it obviously depends on the generosity of loved ones, of people who died, to donate a heart and a lung, et cetera, mm-hmm. to be a life-saving event for the person in need.
So to that end, I am an organ donor. But is there any reason why everyone shouldn't be an organ donor?
No.
Okay, there it is. Nice and succinct. I like that. So obviously you mentioned the role of immunosuppression. Obviously that helps with this long, long list, because the better you get that balance, the more efficiently these organs are used. Because sometimes they are rejected, mm-hmm. right? The first one doesn't okay. necessarily work. But you also mentioned tissue matching, right? So it's not just the drugs that do it. You also sort of match the tissues to what reduce the issues of immunosuppression. How does that work?
Well, first, we have to be blood group compatible, because just like a transfusion would lead to a transfusion reaction, a blood incompatible organ would lead to a rejection response. Tissue matching is extremely important in bone marrow transplantation, where you want to have near perfect matching to avoid graft versus host disease and to have success. In kidney transplantation, the role of matching is less. But if you have a living donor and you happen to have a perfectly matched donor, it makes a very big difference in terms of the long-term survival of the transplant, and it does allow some reduction in the immunosuppression.
What relationship is usually a perfect donor?
Is this a living relative typically?
That's right. So that would be a sibling, right? So you'd have a 1 in 4 chance of having a sibling who would be have the same tissue types as you, got the same chromosome from each of your parents.
So I got two perfect kidney donors. So I can go through 4 kidneys.
Well, but
life.
Are they the same?
No. So you have a 1 in 4, right? So you say 1 in 4 chance that your siblings will be a perfect match. You have a 1 in 4 chance that they'll be 0 match.
Only I got to get Jack out of that bathtub of ice right now.
But are there any patterns that you would see, say, in blood type matching? So I'm O negative, right? And that's a universal donor. Does that make me usually a better match for my siblings as a tissue donor?
Or it'd make it easier, right?
Okay.
I mean, so you're exactly right. You're a universal donor. Okay. Unfortunately for you, you're not a universal recipient.
Yeah, that is a problem.
So you'll need an O donor.
So if one of my siblings tries to hit me with the compact car, I know what they're looking for. It's, and I guess let's dispel a myth, right? Because the nice thing about kidneys is you have two. You can be a living donor. I could donate one to a sibling. We hear all these horrible stories for which I have never seen empirical evidence in the literature of, you know, you had too much Jägermeister, they find you in a phone booth the next day, and there's a giant incision in your back where your kidney used to be. That doesn't really happen, does it?
No.
Okay. I mean, has anyone actually...
As in this field, as in many fields, there are a lot of wild and crazy rumors that on the whole, I think the downside of that is it hurts the perception and the concern that perception would dissuade people from being, you know, organ donors to help people in need.
Okay.
There seem to be a lot of conspiracy theories about organ donorship also. There are folks who are just suspicious of it to start with, make up a lot of stories about why you shouldn't do it and, you know, why. I think the worst one, of course, is the EMTs check your card before they decide how fast to get back to the hospital.
I think transplantation is one of the most regulated areas in medicine, and probably rightly so, because of the, you know, we need to take very good care of a very precious resource, which is the organ for transplant. As a result of that, I think we're far more scrutinized and regulated than many, many other areas, probably most other areas of medicine.
Mm-hmm. Who's regulating you?
It started with a federal law in 1984, which was basically the law that set up the system for transplantation as we know it now, and some basic premise of that, and set up a contract with a not-for-profit agency to basically monitor and carry out transplantation in this country. Took it from a disorganized system to an organized system. One of the aspects of that system is a reporting system, a registry system, so that all centers to be a transplant center are required to report their data and very detailed data. And so as a potential patient or a person or family in need, I think it's a huge asset, because you can go onto the internet and you can find very, very detailed information about a particular organ at a particular transplant center and make informed decisions about your transplant care.
So it's like the Carfax of organ transplantation. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about some new and exciting things involving these new hand transplants that are going out at Emory. We'll be right back with Inside the Black Box, science only funnier.
This is Friction. Friction Wednesdays, 10 p.m. on WREK Atlanta, 91.1 FM. It can be suave. It can be fast. It can be experimental. But it's always just jazz, and you can hear it every weekday from 9 to noon right here on WREK.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking with transplant surgeons extraordinaire Chris Larson and Tom Pearson from Emory University Medical School. And we didn't really announce the number much, because with these medical shows, we have so much to cover, and it's so fascinating. We should probably have you guys back on another day to finish this. But before we get into the interesting hand transplants they've been doing at Emory, let me just remind our callers, if you're listening to us live Wednesdays, noon to 1, and you've got a question or comment on this fascinating topic, give us a call here at the studio at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. So, hand transplants. With the very small vessels that you need a microscope for. What kind of problems does that bring up?
Well, I think in two broad senses. One, in hand transplantation requires immunosuppression just as other solid organ transplants. So we have to deal with the consequences of not enough immunosuppression or too much immunosuppression and the potential side effects of that. I think one of the things that the field wrestles with in hand transplantation is that it's not a life-saving organ. So if you need a heart or you need a liver or you need a lung, you may be willing to accept consequences of immunosuppression because it's the alternative is short-term non-survival. In a hand transplant, it's not that situation. And so I think as immunosuppression management gets better, if we were ultimately able to reach the goal of tolerance induction, being able to fool the immune system at the time of transplant to have it think that this hand is actually self and not non-self, that the potential application of the field would increase. So that's one area, is the immunosuppression area. The other area is the functional area. So as opposed to transplanting a kidney or a liver or heart, where you put it in, you reestablish the blood supply, and the vast majority of time the function begins immediately, that's not the case with a limb transplant, because it depends on nerves and regeneration of the nerves, and that takes time and may occur to variable extents. And so always trying to weigh the potential benefit of a hand transplant and the function that will come out of that, which is not certain ahead of time, versus the risks of the surgery itself, but probably more importantly, the immunosuppression.
Are hands the only thing that people kind of get to make that decision on? Are there any other non-life dependent? What was the phrase you used again?
Life-saving.
Immediately life-saving.
Immediately life-saving transplants.
Well, at least in concept, transplantation could treat a whole host of diseases, right? So there's all the traumatic injuries and other reasons to have amputations, you know, our servicemen and women who've suffered so many amputations, disfigurement from facial trauma with transplantation of tissue there, the larynx that might have been removed for trauma, inability to speak, okay. Control your airway, islets for type 1 diabetes. Type 1 diabetes is caused by the destruction of the cells that make insulin, and we've been involved in that, and just a teaspoon of cells, if you can get them to accept and function, are enough to restore the function for type 1 diabetes.
So that's kind of interesting. I mean, why wouldn't you just do a pancreas transplant? Mm-hmm. Why not a pancreas transplant as opposed to the insulin-producing islet cells?
So pancreas transplants are actually done much, much more frequently than islet cell transplant. Unfortunately, when you transplant a whole pancreas, there is potential morbidity, you know, surgical complications of that. And you don't really need the whole pancreas to treat diabetes. You just need the cells that make the insulin. And so the simple notion is, why subject people to these potential complications if we could just put in the cells that make the insulin? And that's, of course, been a goal and a challenge for several decades.
Okay, so it's basically less invasive.
Correct.
Do you have to put them in the same place where the pancreas would be, or?
You don't. Interestingly, there's not a good technical way to get them re-embedded in the pancreas, and so they're typically infused into the vein that goes to the liver, and then they float into the liver and take up residence there and function there.
Did I mention that this whole show is blowing my mind? Because it is.
Thanks for sharing that with us. But basically, then, are you guys doing better than the old-fashioned view when I was in graduate school and we were taking islet cells and putting in encapsulated, semi-permeable polymer things, none of which worked?
So it's a vexing problem. We have been transplanting in very small numbers patients for about the last 7 or 8 years. Some of those very first recipients are off insulin for 7 years.
Okay,
remarkable.
That's impressive, yeah.
But the technology of producing the islets, getting enough, has been a difficult challenge, really more of an engineering challenge than an immunology challenge. Mm-hmm. So we're not where we want to be, but the promise is there.
Wow.
So it remains an active area of clinical research as opposed to a proven therapy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But you mentioned before, you know, that obviously blood vessels are the first thing you need to reconnect. But then you mentioned nerves and nerve regeneration. I mean, you connect the major blood vessels, the ones that you can. We get some vascular regeneration. But nerves are really, can we connect nerves? Or do we hope they just regenerate?
No, the nerves are connected.
Okay.
But for the nerve to function, the new neural tissue needs to propagate down those nerves that are reconnected. And so as opposed to a blood vessel, when you sew the two blood vessels together, you immediately have normal function, blood flow flowing through those vessels. When you sew two nerves together, you don't have immediate function. And it requires time for the nerve to regenerate and hope that the function comes back with that nerve regeneration.
So my engineering friends like to liken connecting the vasculature as, you know, plumbing. You put the two things together, and if you get a good suture line, you're off and running. Whereas nerves are more like an optical fiber, right? You hope you get them aligned, or that alignment will develop so you get this thing going. So in a hand transplant, best case scenario, what's the best function that you can see when you transplant a hand? I mean, could I type, things like that?
I think the simple answer to that is we don't really know yet. There haven't been enough done, and people followed systematically long enough to truly answer that question. I think some of the videos that are available on people that were received a hand transplant many years ago are amazing. When you see the person, the ability to use their fingers, to tie their own shoes, to be very functional in that sense, is dramatic. But the patients, the recipients will tell you it's not a normal hand.
About how many successful hand transplants have there been?
Well, our colleague, Dr. Sindalis, is the leader of the program at Emory, and I believe the transplant that she performed was the 15th of the United States. Does that sound about
15,
right,
Tom? 15,
1-5. 1-5, yeah. And she was a part of the team that did the original transplants at Louisville, and we had the opportunity to meet one of the first recipients. And it is remarkable to see him, I guess, about 7 years later. Great sensation, good motor function, and clearly benefiting from it. But as Dr. Pearson said, Tom said, Linda emphasizes that you won't have a normal hand, but our key is to restore as much function as we can.
And in this case, the negative control is the current level of prosthetics, you know,
correct,
hooks or these hands.
Back in your engineering world,
exactly.
You know, how well can they hook up prosthetics that sense nerves and sense muscle and perform function? And that's the question.
And even when we have a supercomputer hooked to it to interpret all those signals, we don't do as well as what it sounds like the hand transplants are doing.
And I think, you know, again, I'm sure both fields are evolving, and I think in transplant, as the immunosuppression gets better, then I think we, you know, can hopefully advance the field further. I think, you know, sometimes talking to the recipients, you don't think of the things that we kind of take for granted. And I remember talking to the recipient from Louisville who said one of the most important things was he can now walk through a buffet line and fill his own plate.
Wow.
You know, as opposed to holding the plate, put it down, put some food on it, pick the plate up, move down. You know, it would never occur to one who's not in that situation how important something like that could be.
Yeah. It's the simple things. Mm-hmm. And we mentioned briefly during the break about, earlier you mentioned that there's really no reason for people not to be an organ donor. There are a lot of myths surrounding that, but it's a very important life-saving thing that you should do. But we mentioned during the break that's very cultural. And we were talking about, who was this young man in Italy who donated all his organs a few years back?
Nicholas Green.
And the Italians thought that was just an amazing thing. I'm an organ donor. Charlie, are you an organ donor?
I think I signed
it's
something.
It's one checkbox at the DMV. It's very simple, right? And you mentioned it's very culture dependent, right? Japan is low. Spain is high. I mean, so it's just culture, right? Culture takes a long time to change.
Well, I think it's a combination of legal and culture. So the vast majority of organ donors in this country are people that are brain dead. So they're legally dead by the laws in this country because they have no brain function, but their heart continues to beat. Mm-hmm. In some countries of the world, that legality is not defined or not as well defined. So one aspect is to have the legal system in place, which we do in this country and in most countries. And then the other is, once the legal system is in place, the cultural.
So the legal basis has to be established first. And you mentioned that happened relatively recently in Japan. So maybe that's why that's
correct.
That's like, and I'll be honest with you, I'm not worried about the legal issues. because my wife's going to be the one making that decision, right? Mm-hmm. I'm worried about my wife because she considers me to be in a persistent vegetative state after a couple of Zimas. Mm-hmm. So, you know, she'll be the one. Take it all, Doc. All right, we've actually reached the end of the program where we're going to attempt to address what have we learned.
We've learned that you drink Zima.
I don't drink Zima anymore.
I can no
don't
longer appear on this show.
So where transplants got their start, rumor has it by the Moors, who were actually very advanced in a lot of medical issues in the 5th century, doing a leg transplant that we suspect maybe survived for a few seconds or so, but it really wasn't until
for one sort good of kick.
The last century when, what was it, Alexis Carrel, who actually received the Nobel Prize for understanding it's connecting the blood vessels. That's one of the most important things. So the mechanics has evolved relatively rapidly, but now the biggest hurdle is probably immune suppression and all the immune suppression drugs for which you must take for the remainder of your life, which seems like a big burden, but if you look at the alternative, you know, death coming around the corner because you have a failing organ, you know, it actually increases the quality of life significantly. Addressing the T lymphocytes, the T cells, appear to be the key in immunosuppression. And it's a tricky balance, right? You want to balance it such that it doesn't reject the organ or transplanted tissue, but will keep you from, you know, having severe pathologies just because you get a common cold. All sorts of different drugs for this. The cyclosporins you mentioned were sort of the breakthrough drug for that. And you actually mentioned this before, that one of the issues you mentioned briefly was cancer. I mean, decades ago, we didn't really understand how integral the immune system was to cancer. Now with things like HPV, we understand that's very important. And your colleagues at Emory a few weeks ago said, with modern medicine, it's only a matter of time before cancer rears its ugly head because of this basic systemic approach to it. Shortages of organs are still a problem, and obviously immune suppression can help make those be used in a more efficient fashion. There is no reason why everyone shouldn't be an organ donor, right? That was very clear, so let's take that home. A lot of these, myths about losing your kidney at the local rave are severely exaggerated.
No, dude, it happened to a guy I knew, but yeah. a guy that knew a guy, somebody somewhere, it happened.
Exactly how it happens. And not only for life-saving organs, but there are transplants for, what is it, not immediate life-saving transplants. Things like the new hand transplants, of which only about 15 have been done in this country.
15 successful
hand transplants. The 15th one done right here in Atlanta at Emory University. And other things like treating type 1 diabetes with a transplantation of islet cells.
A teaspoon of cells.
Right. Rather than the pancreas, a less invasive procedure to do that very thing. So it sounds very encouraging. I mean, I think it's going very well. And best of luck with this whole immune suppression balance thing. Did I leave anything out? Anything else you guys want to end on?
Nope. Thank you very much for having us on.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Chris and Tom, thank you very much for being on the program. And if you've got a question or comment about this program or a suggestion for a future show, by all means, send us an email at comments@insidetheblackbox.org. Our chief engineer is Trent Altman, but he was ably replaced by head engineer of the entire station, Daniel Smith, today. We're still wondering if Bill Hunt's ever going to come back. But
is that up in the air?
Yeah, I don't know.
Come on back, Bill.
I don't know. As soon as he's out of rehab, he may be back. But sitting in very ably for him was Charlie Bennett, Warrior King from the library.
Thank you.
Our theme music, which you did not hear today, is written and performed by Bill and Mary Hunt. And next week, we're going to have Eric Prebis, a physicist from Fermilab in the Chicago area, talking to us about these recently measured faster-than-light neutrinos out of CERN. And please join us next week for Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.